We talk about change today, but how many of us really welcome change? Here at St. George's, we've had 5 different buildings, and looking back over the list of leaders who have presided for us, just since I got here, there's Leonard, Connie, Mark, Pam, Steve, John, Alan, Doug, Bob, and Don. And that's only as far back as I can go to 1988. There are people here in the congregation that can go back further and name even more names for you. But overall, the phrase "change is good" is not always the best thing to say to people, as many people prefer the status quo. We don't have to go very far to see an example of this, as all we need to do is rearrange the furniture in the sanctuary. Once we do that, we just sit back and we listen to the complaints and the grumblings and the bickering that goes on. The reason that we have chairs here now and not pews is that there was a desire among people here at the church when the building project was planned to have a worship space that was flexible and which could be moved around to suit the changes in the seasons. I myself, I have to admit, was not fond of giving up my beloved pew, although I myself had not sat on a pew for several years before we moved from the old building, given that the servers were privileged to sit at the highest level on the only padded seats in the place. And unlike everybody else in the building, but it is a credit to the congregation here that as I look around, we have not recreated the previous environment, at least. That's unlike the first church that I ever walked into where they had pew chairs. Our chairs, well, they sit in generally and supposedly straight lines, are not set up the way theirs were. Those chairs were set up in exactly straight lines, and each chair was individually bolted to the floor. They had essentially created for themselves padded pews. And continuing along the lines of change, we get into the first lesson where we hear about Samuel. Now, Samuel at this point has grown very old and he's at odds with the people because the people that follow him want to have a king. They're tired of his leadership and they're upset that he has passed over much of the control to his sons. And the people are complaining that his sons are not as honest as he was and that the people feel that they're being cheated by them. So the people demand that Samuel name them a king to rule over them. But Samuel doesn't like the idea. Samuel asks God what to do, and his response is not even what he wants to hear. God tells him, "Listen to the people. They are not rejecting you, but are again rejecting and turning away from me. Tell them what having a king will mean to them. Warn them about how much they will lose." So Samuel reports back to the people, "These are the ways of the king that will reign over you. And I repeat from the first lesson, he will take your sons. He will appoint for himself commanders. Some will plow his ground and reap his harvest and make his implements of war and equip his chariots. He will take your daughters. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and orchards. He will take 1/10 of your grain. He will take your male and your female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys. He will take 1/10 of your flocks." But most importantly, he finishes off by telling them that you will be his slaves. "In that day, you will cry out for your king, whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you. In spite of all this, the people are still defiant, and they still continue to demand a king, a strong leader that can lead them out into battle like the other groups and countries and tribes around them. But Samuel continues to ignore them, and he tells them to go home. But God has other plans, and we read on into that story a little bit, we'll find that God sends a young man out searching around the wilderness for a donkey that he searches for several days and can't find. But he does find Samuel, and he will be eventually proclaimed king. And I get a kick out of the way they describe him, because it sort of sits there and fits with what the people wanted, and that this young man was chosen because he was the tallest and the most beautiful man in the land. Obviously, he would look good on a horse as he led his people out on a parade. Further along in these stories, we find that this same leader, just like what Samuel had said, by the time his rule is finished, the people are scared to death of him, afraid to look the wrong way at him for fear that he will kill them just on a whim. And that's the way we leave that story. But then we move on to a totally different bit of confusion, in that we are then brought by Mark into Jesus returning home to his village that he grew up in. Jesus is on the move, and his ministry has started. He has gathered together his chosen followers, and he is, as my youngest son Dennis likes to say, he and his band of thugs are traveling around the countryside. They're drawing crowds, healing the sick, and driving out demons. Can you, any of you, imagine what this would have looked like? Jesus was literally a backwater teacher from Nazareth. He had abandoned his home and his family and wandered out through the wilderness, gathering around him a band of the lowest members of their society. And here he's drawing people to him. People are thronging around him. They're grabbing at him as he walks down the road. They're chasing him. They're following him everywhere. It sort of reminds me, when looking back at my youth, the closest thing that I probably would have seen to this, I hate to say, probably would have been Beatlemania. When the Beatles first hit the scene and young girls were literally chasing them down the road and throwing themselves at them, hoping that they would come near them and touch them, tearing their clothes off. But everywhere that Jesus goes, there's crowds. There's these mobs of people forcing themselves into his path and begging him for his help. They even go so far as to rip the roofs off of houses just so they can lower their friends down. And they risk life and limb by diving out, as I said, into the crowd of people walking down the street just to grab at his tunic as he goes by. He returns home. And that's the sort of a situation that he walks into in Nazareth, because the crowd comes with him. He returns home to a town where they knew him growing up. We can only assume that he was thought of as a normal, average boy in every way as he grew up. We don't have a lot of stories about Jesus as a young man, but we can only assume that he spent his youth playing with the other boys, learning how to be a carpenter, because that's what his father did. So that's what would have been expected of him. And here he is being hounded by these people. And he's speaking in riddles and parables that the people that knew him don't understand. He's confronted and he's accused of not only being a demon, but because he can command demons, of actually being Satan himself. And for all accounts, I mean, it probably appears that Jesus at that moment was probably pretty close to being killed by the people that had known him when he was younger. His family rushes out to save him, thinking that he's gone out of his mind and is raving like a madman, because they've never seen him like this before either. And he's told that his mother and his brothers are outside, and that they want him to stop what he's doing and come out to meet with them. But he says no. His mother and his brothers are those people that are sitting there with him, that are surrounding him, that his family is his followers. That these people who do God's will and follow his path are his brothers. In a sense, this is sort of the first definition of the church. And he's referring to what we call the family of God, i.e., us. We are his Christian followers today, and we're part of the body of Christ here on earth. And as part of God's family, and as such, we have a duty to follow his example and his teachings in life. That doesn't mean that our purpose in life is to come to church every week, to sit in the front row or the back one, to sing the songs and listen to someone read either a passage of the Bible or a sermon written just as today. It does not mean that there is an us or a them in church, those who come and sit and listen, or those that sit on the other side of that great divide that we call an altar, that we're either very plain or sometimes extremely fancy garments up at the front. No one is more important than the other person. Jesus changed all the rules. He modified or he totally ignored the laws that men had created in God's name, and he challenged his followers to do the same. Because he did not conform or follow their rules, they called him a madman and accused him of many things, but he never wavered from his goal. Jesus taught love and support through his healing. And in fact, he was the first evangelist. As he sat in place, a plan of spreading God's message, encouraging to later go forth in his name to everyone. A number of years ago now, I was fortunate enough to be part of the initial course at Wycliffe called Mission Shaped Church, led by Professor John Bowen and now Bishop Jenny Anderson. In that first class, John went around the room asking people, we have one person sitting back there that was there with me, knows they were mostly priests, what they thought when they heard the word evangelist. He had finished going around the room when he realized that he had not yet asked me and demanded an answer to his question. Well, my first and my only thought was simple and to the point, although I didn't want to say it. Basically, Southern Baptist Bible thumper. When I think of evangelist, that's what I thought about. And that was my only reply. I'm sorry to say John gripped his forehead, said something like, "Oh no, so you're one of those," and turned and walked away. Later on in that course, I told him that we had finally received permission to build this great building, and that we would have a fully accessible space where we could worship and could reach out from. His reaction was swift, simply asking, why? Why would we want to waste money building a building when our mission as the church was to go out into the world every Sunday, privately praying, doing God's work, and spreading his message? We were not meant to sit inside our four walls, worshiping our God. During that and every week, that's why so many churches are in trouble today, is because that's exactly what they do. They sit there and they worship unto themselves, not to the world around them. You may not be aware of it, but during that course, they told us about one of the fastest growing churches and one of the largest Christian churches in the world. This church doesn't have a place to worship. It is made up specifically of small groups, a multitude of small groups, meeting separately every week, sharing the same message, and constantly training the next person who will go out from that group and will repeat the same process at another location. So our job as Christians is to change how we do things and how we think. In my mind, the church years ago probably had a much better grip on what it should have done than it has maybe over the past 100 years or so, when it has become self-centered and inward-looking in many cases. Our goal is to go out into the world around us, being followers and extensions of Christ and his mission every day, not just for that hour and a half on Sunday morning. Now, rather than make this really difficult, I suggest that we start simple and not overcomplicate things. And if possible, follow two general rules going forward. As that great songwriter Neil Diamond stated in the 1960s hit, Brother Love's Travel and Salvation Show, he gave us a great starting point for being a Christian today. I said, brothers, now you got yourself two good hands, and when your brother is troubled, you got to reach out your hand to him, because that's what it's there for. And when your heart is troubled, you got to reach out your other hand, reach it out to the man up there, because that's what he's there for.